We're going to play some of that this weekend, too.
WKLO time is 10:29 or whatever.
The time, 12 o'clock, the time. And when I first heard that, I was working at KLO in the mid-70s, and the engineer said, there's a bunch of tapes there in a box, and I'm going to throw them out unless somebody takes them, so if you want any of it. And I went, oh, my gosh. And I looked down there, and there's all these reels of jingles.
Yeah.
Of course, I found out that about 10 other people have reels of jingles. So I thought I got the originals.
Weird, I remember the strangest experience I had with radio probably is when I was in the Army. I came back to Louisville on leave one time as one of the tapes that I gave. It was in 63.
Right.
And I'd been working in Columbia, South Carolina while I was in the Army in a couple of, on a part-time job in a...
WKLO!
That was one of them.
In a real loose format kind of station, you know, it was... kind of bring your own records, play whatever you want to play, you know, do whatever you want to do as long as it's not illegal, you know, that type of thing. And came back to the station after being away for about a year and was talking to some of the guys, and they said, hey, well, you know, Paul's not going to be here tonight for some reason. Callie, we need somebody to fill in. Would you be interested in working? I said, hey, you know, yeah, sure, that'd be kind of fun. So I'm basically jumping into the studio without any awareness of what the format is, you know, what kind of jingles they're using, you know, anything. I mean, and, you know, stations had, you know, record formats, you know, how many records you're supposed to play, you know, which one, which time of the hour, and all this sort of stuff. And in this particular air show segment, it's just like this plotting, you know, let's see now, which button do I push, you know, oh yeah, boom, push this one. And this clock thing was just like a big box that sat in the control room and essentially had a clock mechanism that kept this tape advanced all the time so that whenever you pushed the button, it gave you the current time. You know, it was really odd. And, you know, you kept hearing this thing over and over again. After a while, you knew the tune, you know, it's a different times of the day and whatever, but it was pretty bizarre. The other interesting thing was moving from the Commonwealth Building to Walnut Street, which I was working there when we did that.
1965, was it?
No, I think it was 64.
Okay.
I'm sure it was 64. And somebody was talking earlier about KLO having a studio on the street level on Broadway, and I don't think that ever happened to my knowledge. I mean, because I was working at the station right up to the time that we moved from the Commonwealth Building and right over to Walnut Street, and we never had a, you know, unless it was a remote show or something like that to somebody.
Yeah, that might have been it, yeah.
But the culture shock of moving from, I mean, this studio right here is a palatial palace compared to the studio that we worked out of in the Commonwealth Building, which was about half this size.
I remember that room. Ed Bowman let me cue up Surf and Safari by the Beach Boys in the summer of 62 down there.
And the place, I mean, it was small, dingy, sort of, you know, you felt like it was closing in on you all the time.
Right.
The floor was built up because it had all the wiring underneath the floor, so you stepped up, and therefore the ceiling was only about, you know, a foot over your head when you were standing up. And you look,
they had a raised floor because of all the wiring under the floor.
And all you got to see all day was the newsman who sat right in front of you, you know, through a plate glass window.
And if it was Omar Andil, boy, what a thrill, right?
Or Bob Henry.
Yeah.
And you couldn't really see outside. If you wanted to, you had to kind of go back to the side of the control room and look out the window. You know, you had to go over to the window to be able to see if it was, you know, raining out there.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, going over to Walnut Street, which was, you know, Showcase Studio right on the street, was really, you know, was really a shock because you weren't used to having people watch you work.
Right.
And I think some of the guys mentioned it earlier today, and I really found this out later, is that it was a great psychological thing after you got used to it to have real contact with people.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, doing a show with like we are now without really seeing anybody who could even possibly be listening, without even knowing. I mean, right now we don't know if it's raining outside or anything else.
Right.
And when you got in the studio, you could react to the environment, you know, and the people that were coming by, and it, you know, just kind of kept you motivated. Probably the worst time that I worked in the studio was like middays on Saturday, which always seemed to be extraordinarily boring,
right?
And slow because
a lot of listeners, though.
Yeah, but there wasn't much downtown traffic, you know, pedestrian traffic, and compared to the times of day when there were a lot of people out there, it was like
get some people down here.
You know, I'm falling asleep. You know, I can't take this anymore. But it was really a, and of course we went to totally new equipment. You know, all the studio equipment was replaced. The other thing that's I guess people don't know that much about the behind the scenes side of broadcasting is that when I came to work for WKLO, all of the commercials that we used on the air were on large electrical transcriptions, you know, right. big records.
Right.
And we had four turntables in the control room, and that was it. I mean, that's where you played all the records, you know, the music and all the commercials.
And we didn't have things like
WKLO,
which was just played on a tape cartridge, which
We had jingles then, but the jingles were also on ETs.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to play anything, you had to cue it up, hold the sucker, and let it go when it was time for it to go. Then, of course, we went to cartridge machines. I was out of broadcasting by the time CDs came along. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at that time, if you were doing, say, an afternoon, one of the things that was really crazy about KLO up until the time that Mitch Michael became program director was that it was always really heavy on commercials, and particularly in drive time.
Right, and then Mitch, did away with a lot of that?
He basically said, we can't win with that many commercials on the air, so we're going to cut back on the number of commercials we allow on the air.
Right, but the number of minutes per hour. Yeah.
But if you worked, say, a morning or afternoon drive with 2 5-minute newscasts an hour, you might, if you were lucky, get maybe 3 records in during an hour.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of the time, it was all commercials and news. And sometimes you'd have
3 records per hour back then.
3 records,
and
you would.
About 2 or 3 minutes.
If you were running the commercials during that time, you might have 5 commercials between, or 6 or 7 commercials between records, mm-hmm. and you only had 4 turntables, which means that one comes off, another one goes on, cue that one up. Let's see now which one goes next. Usually you've got 2 turntables running because when you started them, you'd start the turntable and hold the record, you know, right on the cue. And
then, slip cueing.
Yeah, slip cue, and then you let it go. And it was crazy. I mean, it was just, it was like physical work, you know, when you're doing a show like that.
Sure.
And middays, you know, it wasn't as bad, but it was still the same principle. And then, of course, cartridges came along, and, you know, cartridges were, you know, self-cueing, so you didn't have to worry about that. And
when did you first use cartridges? Do you remember?
When we went, I think we started when we were still over in the Commonwealth Building. I would say it was probably during the time that I was in the Army, which was probably 62 or 63,
okay.
because they had cartridges when I came home in 63, and I don't think we had them when I left to go
now,
to the Army.
For anybody that is listening to this and doesn't know, the cartridges we're referring to, they are now in stereo, of course, but and a lot of stations as far as music now go to CDs, but they still play a lot of their commercials on cards. It's just like an 8-track, but not
like
exactly along the same principle there.
Well, basically what it is a continuous piece of tape that's
right.
a particular length. Like it would be a 30-second spot, you'd have a 40-second cartridge, so it would have some re-cueing time on it. So when the tape plays all the way through, it comes right back around to the start again. So, or if you'd have a 5-minute cartridge, it might have, say, 4 1-minute spots on it. You know, so you have, whenever it stops, it's ready to start again. It's
right.
not like cassette tape that you'd play in your home stereo or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a continuous piece of tape. And that was a great invention, you know, for disc jockeys and news people because, you know, before that it was ETs, electrical transcriptions, or reel-to-reel tape machines, which we also used a lot.
Man, and we are talking about, like you said, manual labor, a lot of work.
Absolutely.
And you know what I remember somebody saying probably about the time you were on KLO in 62, 63 or something and said, all those disc jockeys do is sit down there and play records.
That's I remember that. Probably one of the greatest misconceptions that people have. It's easier today, obviously, with all the technology that you have to work with. But probably one of the greatest misconceptions that people had about what it was like to be a disc jockey was that it was not very hard work. You know, whereas the fact of the matter is, most people that did the work thought it was really hard work. I mean, you did a 3 or 4 hour record show, you were tired when you got through.
Gosh.
And not just from talking for that period of time, but because of all the work that you were doing.
And then because of tape carts, I had to do overnights for 7 hours at one time. Yeah, that got old. I don't care if I had somebody in there working all the controls for me. That was, you know, after a while, you get burnt out on it.
That was another interesting aspect of the studio on Wallace Street, though, I think, was the fact that people could now see what you did when you did a record show. I mean, they could right. stand out there and watch you do it. And, of course, you know, I had carts and it was easier, but it was still, hey, this guy doesn't just sit there and you know, do his shtick. And, of course, we were not like the big city guys that had engineers who, you know, did all the production work and they just sat there and talked. We mm-hmm. did the whole thing. You know, we ran the tapes, ran the records, you know, cleaned the floor, answered the phone, you know, did the whole nine yards. So, you know, it's... I guess the thing that I had that was probably different than a lot of people that worked in this business is that I didn't really have a glamorized kind of view of this business. My father was in radio for most of his, well, for all of his life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a family where radio was the profession, and this is what you did for a living. So
right.
I really didn't want to get into radio. Getting into it because I figured it was a better way to make a living than anything else I could figure out at the time. And... you know, to me, it was a job, a profession. It was what you did, you know, for a living. And
sure.
And a lot of guys were in it basically because they thought it was, you know, showbiz. You know, I mean, this is the big time, you know.
Okay.
I love doing this. It's a lot of fun, that sort of thing. And I had fun doing it. I'm not putting that down because I really enjoyed radio. But I guess I just had a different, it was in a different perspective to me than it was for some people because to me, this was my work and that's what I did for a living.
Yeah, I viewed it as that, I guess, for the most part, until, you know, I really got off the air, got out of it.
Yeah.
I always wanted to, you know, be as professional as I could, no matter how much I got sick of it, what kind of mood I was in that day and everything. But some days, you walk in there and you just don't feel like going on the air again.
Well, it was a nightmare for me, some because I'm not a morning person, and I worked for about 3 years with Bailey in the morning, and I had to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning. The first newscast was at 5:55, and I'd get up at about 4:15 or 4 o'clock or somewhere in that neighborhood and cruise in there at about 5 o'clock or somewhere in that neighborhood, and I had to, you know, take all the news off the wire and, you know, do a lot of stuff to check what was going on overnight, get the news ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated getting up. I mean, once I got there and got in the groove of things, I enjoyed being there, but
right.
I hated, you know, that getting up process and frequently didn't make it exactly when I was supposed to. You know, we'd get in there at maybe 15 minutes till 6, you know, 10 minutes before the first newscast sometimes.
Like I said to Randy Etcher today about 5 times, you know, that's still going on, Alan.
Oh, I'm sure.
Doesn't change very much.
The funniest story about doing that, though, is I worked 9 to noon for quite a while back in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would expect somebody could get up by 9 o'clock.
Right.
Well, I lived at about Eastern Parkway and the North-South Expressway, which is fairly close to downtown. I mean, it's not a, you know, it's not out in the suburbs. And I would usually get into the studio by the time the first record ended, you know, in my show, because the guy that was on before me would start the record, you know, after the newscast.
Yeah.
And I would usually be there to take it off, you know, once it got off the air.
But, so you timed it out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would get
remember
up.
Remember that, Rusty?
I would get up at, say, 15 till 9.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be on the air at 9 o'clock. And I would, you know.
I bet you looked real good too.
Oh yeah. Well, see, I didn't have to be seen. I mean, this was in the Commonwealth Building.
Yeah.
And nobody cared what I looked like.
Hey, man, didn't you wear a suit and tie every day?
No.
Like was on the tune decks?
No.
You mean you guys were lying to us back then? You actually didn't look like that all the time?
No. Most of the time, we didn't really look like that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, that was a fun experience too. The other one thing I think you and I talked about the other day was some of the virtual nightmare people that you followed on the air in terms of their personal hygiene
right.
and habits. Of,
right.
And Joe Holcomb, I don't know.
Rusty Rogers and people like that, yeah.
This guy named Joe Holcomb, who was the morning man.
You're in an enclosed room, and I do have a gag okay?
This guy would, I mean, he would have coffee all over the place, you know, cigarette ashes in the coffee.
And who was this again?
Joe Holcomb.
Uh-huh. You know,
he was the morning man back in the early 60s, and I was working 9 to noon. So
yeah, Joe's going to be here in about 10 minutes, Alan.
He knows this. I mean, I tell him about it every day.
Did you?
Yeah. And
I had a roommate like that worked at WCII with me, and I loved the guy to death, but he was a slob.
Oh, terrible. And I was real neat.
I'd probably get killed for that.
So I was... You know, tried to leave it, you know, the way I'd like to have it found for myself, you know, it's
right.
But it, you know, some of the guys were just horrible. I mean, you just dread going to work because you knew it's going to take you the first 15 minutes of your show with paper towels and, you know, cleaning up everything, destroying all the debris that was left in there.
And it's kind of hard to, come out of a record and go, hey, that's Ricky Nelson, man. I'm really in a good mood this morning cleaning up Joe Holcomb's crap.
Right. I wish he'd do it himself.
This is Alan Bryan, part-time disc jockey and maid.
Yeah. Another bizarre experience we had one day when we were on Walnut Street. I used to park in the Penn Dennis Club lot down in the corner, which is like a block down from the radio station. Of course, I'm doing news and monitoring the police monitors all the time. And I heard this call on the police monitor that there was a car in the middle of the street at 3rd and, what would it be, 2nd and Walnut at the time, which was a block down from where we were located. And I didn't really register when they, you know, first put it out. And I thought, just another routine call. And then I kind of stayed tuned to it in the back of my mind. And the guy got over there, and he's talking to the dispatcher about it. And I thought, I think that may be my car. So I jump on the telephone and call the police dispatch. I said, ask the guy what kind of car that is. And he told him, he said, yeah, that's mine.
Oh, man.
So I beeline out the door down to the street. I'd parked it, didn't set the parking brake or something, and my car just rolled right out. And fortunately, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and there was not a lot of traffic at the time of day.
And that's worse than being Bob Klein and winning the news tip of the week that you got off a wacky and thinking you're going to go to prison because you got it off another radio station.
Oh, yeah. Fraud.
Yeah.
Danger.
No, it was an actual story, though.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
You know, you guys just got it second because I got it off wacky that got it first.
Sure.
You know,
and like I said, sometimes that would have been a big story.
Mm-hmm.
Some weeks, though, you know, we might have had one news tip. That was it. It got the award.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened if you didn't have a news tip?
Well, we usually found somebody. You know.
We used to make news stories up, and I didn't. We did. You know, when I was working, when I first started at Secret of the Trade, they still do it in television news, too. One of the stories, you know, like an unidentified Oklahoma woman claims to have been abducted by alien beings and, you know, strange stuff like
I believe every one of those stories I hear.
They're
you mean
true.
Those are fraud?
You mean they're not true?
Well, actually, everything in National Enquirer is true. I just want you to know that, Bob.
Right.
Really.
Yeah. I read it three times a day, whether I need it or not.
And if you don't, it'll always be on CNN.
Okay, you want to give me a message, you can just give it to me right here.
I'll be
here
back
on the
later.
Okay.
Because
he'll be back later.
Okay, you going to Hi-Fi Club, Rusty?
No, I'm
going to
go grab a nap.
Okay.
Since Mac and I are going to be on doing this all-night thing tonight.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
We do want you to call us tonight because we're going to be playing your records. The number is 589-4801, 589-4801.
And that's the same number for the Mason-Dixon line, which will be on at 9 o'clock tonight.
It's 589-4801,
589-4801.
If you want to call now, we'll take some calls now, too.
589-4801.
Right. We need a reverb machine in here.
We need echo.
589-4801.
Who needs a reverb machine, man? I got hands. Okay, we're going to try to get a hold of Paul Kelly here in a minute, and thanks a lot, Alan.
Did you ever do the helicopter thing? You know, it's like... From high in the sky and over down level. It's 44 degrees, and there's plenty of cars, and they're all stalled, they're all messed up.
Stay home. Stay home today.
Oh, great. The Ranch House in New Albany is where we're going to do the Hi-Fi Club remote tonight, a remote broadcast from there. The Car Club, I guess, of Southern Indiana is going to be there. It could be from Louisville, but it's from the Kentuckiana area. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing we didn't get to use at WKLO in the 70s at one time. There's no such place as Kentuckiana anymore. Right. We're just going to change the whole landscape. But, Alan, thanks a lot for coming here and talking with
us. Enjoyed it.
And, by the way, I saw a survey earlier today that said Barney Groven, 6 to 9 a.m. and 3 to 6 p.m. The guy did mornings and afternoons on the same radio station?
I don't remember that yet regularly. It may have happened, you know, for some period of time. He was there all the time. Certainly he could have worked any hour of the day or night.
Slept at the radio station.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to play a few records here, a little bit of music, and then we're going to go over to New Albany to the Hi-Fi Club. Alan, again, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And see you back on the air tomorrow.
Yeah.
Alan Bryan, who was with WKLO from 1960 until 1972, did news, was a disc jockey. Also owned the radio station 14 times. You know, got fired 36 times and rehired 72 times. So No, Alan did a little bit of everything. It's good talking to you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks a lot. And we'll go over to New Albany as soon as we get in touch with him. A little hard to do it when we're on the air, folks, you know. But we can talk about things like that these days. We're going to go back to 1965 for a promotional announcement that was made right here on this radio station. Here it is.
This is Much More Music Month on the new Radio WKLO, Louisville's leadership station. We're out to set a new world's record for playing more music in 1 month than any other radio station in the nation ever. Count the music where the music counts on the new Radio WKLO, Kentuckiana's leadership station.
WKLO.